This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with ethics professor Ellen Yaroshevsky about a complaint against Kellyanne Conway.
Kellyanne Conway, Trump's spokeswoman and counselor. Well, she's also a lawyer in the D.C. bar, and she's also a liar. What's going to happen to her after the complaint gets heard?
Attorney Todd Pierce joins us to talk about a military case that may be going for the U.S. Supreme Court.
This is extremely dangerous because it could allow the military to run its own courts, imprison indefinitely journalists like us for criticizing the government.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
President Donald Trump and his main advisor, Steve Bannon, have declared war on any press that is critical of them. Last week, in an historically unprecedented move, they banned the New York Times and CNN from a news conference. President Trump's spokesperson, Kellyanne Conway, has countered factual reporting with what she calls alternative facts, that is, lies. In order to raise the fear level of the population, 2 weeks ago, she falsely claimed two Muslims carried out a terrorist massacre in Bowling Green, failing to indicate whether it was Bowling Green, New York, Bowling Green, Ohio, or Bowling Green, Kentucky. Also that week, she promoted Ivana Trump's product line, trying to perk up sales of Trump's fading brand after her jewelry and dresses were dropped by Nordstrom and other department stores. Kellyanne Conway is a lawyer who graduated from George Washington School of Law in Washington, D.C. Lawyers' unethical and illegal conduct is monitored there by the Bar Association. In response to her unethical conduct, a number of law professors who specialize in legal ethics filed a complaint with the association. One of those professors, attorney Ellen Yaroshevsky, a specialist in ethics who teaches at Hofstra Law School, joins us today to speak about Kellyanne Conway's conduct detailed in the complaint. Ellen Yaroshevsky is a former staff attorney and then a board member at the Center for Constitutional Rights. She is a leader of the National Lawyers Guild, and currently she's the director of the Monroe Friedman Institute for the Study of Legal Ethics at the law school at Hofstra University.
Professor Ellen Yaroshevsky, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, Heidi.
Well, we were thrilled to read about the law professor's letter. Can you outline briefly the thrust of it?
Sure. 15 legal ethics professors around the country sent a letter to the disciplinary committee in Washington, D.C., indicating that Kellyanne Conway had violated a fundamental ethics rule. The ethics rule that exists throughout the country says lawyers cannot engage in conduct involving dishonesty, deceit, fraud, or misrepresentation. And it's a rule. The rule is 8.4C. It exists in every jurisdiction for every single lawyer in the country. And what we did in the letter was we outlined some of the lies that she's told over time. We focus on the so-called Bowling Green massacre. If you recall what she said when they were trying to justify the travel ban on seven countries, she said, quote, "I bet it's brand new information to people that President Obama had a six-month ban on the Iraqi refugee program after two Iraqis came here to this country, were radicalized, and were the masterminds behind the Bowling Green massacre." Well, as people know, there was no such thing as the Bowling Green massacre. In Bowling Green, Kentucky, there were two people who had pled guilty to crimes at some point. And what's really interesting is also the New York Post reported that in Bowling Green, New York, there was a statue that was erected to King George sometime right after the Revolution. And when people got so mad, they knocked off the head of that. So I don't think she was talking about that, but she certainly made this up. And she apologized the next day. And so you have to look at that, right? Well, it turns out that her apology, frankly, I think was a lie as well, was false, because the Washington Post did a study and showed that on 7 prior occasions, she'd also talked about the Bowling Green Massacre as if it really existed. So that was one of the lies. We then talked about the fact that she continued that same false statement and talked about Obama, President Obama, imposing a formal 6-month ban on Iraqi refugees, which also did not occur. I mean, it was just completely false. And then, of course, we know that she famously, in an interview, and I think she got caught with factual lies, said, well, there are alternative facts. Okay, and
she was the one that coined that term.
Well, we think she's the one who coined the term. We never heard anybody use it before. It was pretty shocking at the time to hear someone who is a lawyer, who is a spokesperson, who's, quote, counselor to the president, go on the air and talk about something called alternative facts. It really upends the universe, right? It upends the whole notion that there's such a thing as facts in the world. And so, yeah, it was quite disturbing.
I read Dean Baquette, the editor of the New York Times.
Yeah.
They had a staff meeting to talk about what the hell do we do about this. And finally, they realized that we should just call it what it is. An alternative fact is a lie.
It's a lie. It's completely a lie. And I think Tepper, is that his name? I'm not really sure. He did that on the air, too, and said, Kelly, well, there are no such thing as alternative facts. They are lies. And so when we thought about this, and we talked about it extensively, here's the question. She works for the government. She is a lawyer. She is counselor to the president. And should lawyers who are working outside of representing an individual client be bound by the ethics rule? And the answer is absolutely, particularly when they are counselor to the president. We have an expectation that the government is supposed to serve all the people in this country. I know that's a little cynical at this point because it doesn't seem that's the case, but at least that's the theory of government. And if you as a lawyer are going to undertake to serve the president and serve the people of the country, you have an absolute obligation, I think a higher obligation, to a sense of truth. I mean, we're not the only ones to say this, but by the way, you may recall in the 80s that Elliot Abrams was convicted of perjury for lying about the Iran-Contra affair, and he's a lawyer, and he was working in the government, and lawyers who are convicted of crimes, they are also subject to disbarment and suspension for crimes. She hasn't committed a crime yet, but Elliot Abrams at the time was suspended for a year. And the D.C. bar was really clear, and the courts were absolutely really clear that lawyers have a higher obligation. Here's what the court said, okay? No moral character qualification for bar membership is more important than truthfulness and candor, and attorneys require to be a person of good moral character, and not only at the time of admission to the bar, but also thereafter. And so they took very seriously that despite the fact he was pardoned by Bush, that he should still be subject to discipline as a lawyer, right? And so Conway, even though she hasn't committed a crime yet, she has lied repeatedly. She is a lawyer. As one of my colleagues who signed the letter said, look, if Trump wants to lie, he should get someone to work for him who's not a lawyer. Lawyers can't lie. She should get another political person to do so. So it wouldn't be the first time that the D.C. bar has obviously considered the conduct of lawyers who are in government. Elliot Abrams, Scooter Libby is another example of a lawyer who also violated the law. And they do consider the ethics rules for government lawyers.
Now, Ellen, what do you say to those critics who assert that politicians' statements, even those who are lawyers, are protected by the First Amendment and that this will have a chilling effect in the future?
We've gotten a number of critiques, mostly from other law professors, interestingly enough. We've gotten a lot of letters in support of our letter from other lawyers. Look, this is a very narrow exception. Politicians, if they're working as politicians, they can lie all they want, I suppose, even if they're lawyers. We don't like that, but that's not certainly going to subject to discipline. I mean, if Donald Trump were a lawyer, he could lie so long as he doesn't violate the law. But remember, Bill Clinton was the president. Bill Clinton was convicted of perjury. He had to give up his bar membership. So it's not as if lawyers who are politicians are not bound by law. They're bound by the law that says if you commit a crime, then you can be disbarred. But merely for First Amendment rights, of course they can make First Amendment statements. But our argument is just as lawyers individually cannot lie to courts, they can't make misrepresentations to courts, they can't make misrepresentations in other arenas when you are working for the government as a counselor to the president. You're not just being a politician. You're saying, I am the president's counselor. You're holding yourself out as having some credibility because you are a lawyer. In that circumstance, there really should not and is not First Amendment protection.
And arguably, you're set an example to young attorneys across the nation.
Well, certainly.
Yeah.
I mean, look, reasonable people could disagree about the scope of this. And Stephen Lubet, I know you have his note, is one of them. There was a vitriolic back and forth on one of the listservs that I'm on with lawyers who are professional responsibility lawyers, saying this would undermine the First Amendment. But they really didn't understand the carve-out here. And it's really important that government, we repeat this again, that if you're going to work for the government and if you're going to work as a counselor, right, which is in effect acting as a lawyer, even if you're not necessarily giving legal advice about any given circumstance, you are bound by the rules of professional responsibility.
Ellen, I thought it was interesting that in your letter of complaint, you talked about how all law students are now required to take a course in ethics and professional responsibility, and that this came out after the Watergate scandal. And you, of course, teach professional responsibility to students. What do you tell them that first day of class about what is an ethicist?
Well, I mean, there's ethicists and then there's ethicists. There are people who, you know, look at moral philosophy and ethics in that way. I'm not one of those people. I'm a person who actually knows the rules of responsibility, professional responsibility, can talk about the reasons why they're imposed, can talk about the conduct we expect of lawyers. I mean, it may sound quaint to people, but we really expect a great deal of the profession. If you are going to be a lawyer, you should be a person who is trustworthy. And that's fundamental to the notion of being a professional. I mean, think about being a doctor. Would you want to go to a doctor who, like, lies to you about what's wrong with you? And you wouldn't want to go to a lawyer either unless you could have some trust in that person and understand that they can preserve your confidences and that they're a person who's worthy.
And I think that at the core of this is the notion of a conflict of interest. That as a lawyer representing somebody, you cannot have an interest in opposition to that of your client. And I wanted to ask you in that regard about Kellyanne Conway's getting on television and promoting Ivanka Trump's product line. What's wrong with that?
Well, it's been universally condemned because there's a federal ethics rule that you can't specifically do that, right? If you're working for the federal government, you may not promote an individual for the purpose of a product or anything else for the purpose of making money. So, this caused quite a stir, I suppose, because it was the subject of a great, great deal of press that she actually had violated the federal ethics rule. She could be disciplined for that. She could lose money. Presumably she could be fired, but that's certainly not going to happen. We included that in our complaint as well.
Now, procedurally, does a formal complaint such as yours have to be filed, or could the ethics board decide on its own that they've seen some examples of misconduct and go after her?
The disciplinary board in every jurisdiction can on its own decide that it wants to look at the conduct of a lawyer. I mean, we encourage disciplinary boards to open up the legal newspaper every day and say, look at that lawyer who's violated certain rules. A court has just said this prosecutor engaged in misconduct, or this defense lawyer didn't provide effective assistance, or this civil lawyer has a significant conflict of interest. Disciplinary board, you on your own should consider that. So they certainly can. Would they in this case without a complaint? Probably not.
What about the fact that some of the signers of the complaint are members of the D.C. bar, and are they under any kind of obligation to act affirmatively when they see something that's not kosher?
Lawyers around the country, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, have a rule that says if you have knowledge that a lawyer has engaged in conduct that is a substantial challenge to their honesty, fitness, and trustworthiness to practice, you must report support them. So that we put that in the complaint as well, because at least the lawyers, I mean, we feel that way as well, but all the lawyers in D.C. certainly believe that they're bound by that rule. That rule exists in every jurisdiction.
It would be interesting if thousands of attorneys across the nation started to file complaints. Ellen, could you talk about the lawsuit filed by former White House legal counsels and legal scholars that claim that Trump is receiving payments from foreign governments? Is this illegal or unconstitutional?
The Constitution has a clause, Article 1, Section 9, called the Emoluments Clause. This is now in the popular press. Nobody knew this thing until Trump took office, right? You've never heard of it. People now know how to spell it as well, all right? And so and that's what it says. It says you may not, without the assent of Congress, accept payments from foreign governments. And as you well know, there are just numerous examples, beginning with Russia, and then you can go through country by country by country, of instances in which the president has allegedly violated the Emoluments Clause. So some of the most well-known and highly regarded constitutional scholars in the country, Lawrence Tribe at Harvard, Erwin Chemerinsky, who's the dean at UC Irvine, Richard Painter, who was the counsel to Bush, Republican, Norman Eisen, they filed a lawsuit. That lawsuit is pending, saying that Trump violated that clause. I frankly don't think that lawsuit's going anywhere. But there will be, and the reason you want to hear, the reason yes. is there's in the law, there's something called standing, which is to say you can't file a lawsuit unless you're injured in some way. And the professors who filed the lawsuit said their injury is, by having to do this case, it's taking them away from the rest of their work. Now, and that's not a very strong claim.
No.
But it turns out that the ACLU is actually looking for plaintiffs who own properties, who have been damaged as a result of Trump's involvement with foreign governments. So it's not the end of the Emoluments Clause story. I think this suit won't go anywhere, but we will see another one.
Well, Norman Eisen, who you just mentioned, who was an administration lawyer under Obama, said about Trump, we're talking about a candidate who was aggressively seeking large quantities of these foreign governmental intellectual property protection during the campaign, and who, through the businesses that he will continue to own, he'll not only seek to maintain but expand those, presumably. What's your thoughts on that? I mean, the guy's out there still doing business, and he's the president.
He shouldn't be doing that. That's a serious conflict of interest. It's a violation of the Constitution. Hopefully this lawsuit or something is going to expose these problems. Remember that before he got elected, there were proposals that he should do what other government officials have done, like Bloomberg. I mean, Bloomberg took over New York. He put all his holdings in what we call a blind trust, which means he has no connection to them whatsoever. That was the proposal for Trump. Trump, of course, wouldn't do that. He would have to sell off some of his properties. He didn't want to do that. It would cost money. And people said, well, you ran for president. I mean, if you want to be president, you can't be president at the same time that you're going to make a profit from being president. So you have to give up these holdings. And he wouldn't do it. Instead, what he did was he put these properties in the name of his children, which certainly doesn't help because he has an involvement in that. So we now face a situation where from reporting in the New York Times and Washington Post, since 2008, he's gotten 400 trademarks in 28 countries around the world. Sorry, there's an estimate that over time there's something like 80 countries that are involved in trademarks. And it's not just his hotels. Like in Israel, he's got a trademark for vodka.
You know why? Because the vodka that they're peddling under his name over there is made with potatoes, so it's kosher.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's great. I don't know what other vodkas have potatoes. What can I say? I'm not going to on air tell you my favorite brand of vodka, but it may also
be
one.
That would be unethical.
It would be unethical. Maybe one that has potatoes. But China, Canada, Mexico, the European Union, Indonesia, the Philippines, you know, soap and engineering. I mean, every kind of product you could think of, they have sought trademarks. And so here they are engaging in, you know, sales around the world, from the smallest thing like Donald Trump's soap, right, to owning hotels and owning properties. And by the way, the hotels are no longer apparently called Trump hotels. Now they're calling them Scion, S-C-I-O-N. So if you see that too is a Trump product. But I mean, is the presidency really being used for their private profit? It certainly looks like that. And we need to know, at least we need to know more as a country.
Ellen, do I sound naive, but I want to see his tax returns. Well, what do you think about that?
Of course we should see his tax returns.
And can that be forced at some point?
No.
No.
No, I mean, unless you have some proof that failure to turn over his tax returns is somehow illegal and part of emoluments. I mean, that's a stretch. And here's the problem. There's laws and then there's norms. We've had norms up until Donald Trump of what presidents do and what presidents-to-be do. Everybody releases their taxes while they're running because you want to see whether or not, you know, does he have involvement in Russia? I mean, that's been the claim or among the claims. And the idea that he won't do it, it's not a violation of law, but it's a violation of the fundamental norms of how this country has worked for 250 years.
His ban on immigrants and travelers from seven mostly Muslim countries has been stalled, at least for the present. But what was interesting, and what I'd like to ask you to comment on, is that he did not ban people from Saudi Arabia or Egypt, two countries where he's got financial holdings.
Correct. And that, I mean, that's all we know, right? Because there's no transparency in this administration. And we certainly know that he does have holdings in those countries. So is there some kind of arrangement that was made with Saudi Arabia and Egypt because he wanted to continue his businesses there? And therefore, he said, we're not going to ban people from those countries. We just don't know. And the problem is certainly the optics and beyond the optics are terrible. And the question is, are they ever going to release information the way you're supposed to in a democracy so that we have some sense of actually how decisions are being made?
Ellen, it would seem that the Trump administration, even just in its first month, has provided much material to teach in an ethics class. Do you think you and other law professors, ethics professors, will use some of these examples?
Well, absolutely. But, you know, one has to be careful. Remember, there are Trump supporters in law schools, right? And so when I teach, for instance, when he was first elected, there's the whole question of Dodd-Frank, right? And I was teaching Dodd-Frank and the role of lawyers because each time, by the way, there has been some, like Enron, or whatever it is, anytime there's an unlawful action, Volkswagens and cars, there are always lawyers involved, right? And we in the profession have spent inordinate amount of time in meetings determining what should be the role of lawyers in those circumstances. Should lawyers report? Do lawyers have to report? Are they permitted to report? And so Dodd-Frank was one of those laws that looked at that question. And so I'm teaching Dodd-Frank, and he got elected. And I said, we're not going to have Dodd-Frank anymore. What does that mean in terms of a lawyer's responsibility? So that's just one minor example of how we look at this. I'm going to use this complaint because when I teach government ethics, it's an interesting question as to how far the First Amendment. Should government lawyers have a special responsibility to truthfulness, even when they are not necessarily officially representing a client, but they are counselor to the president?
And what kind of oath of office, for example, does Kellyanne Conway take? Does she take an oath in her position?
I don't think
no.
so,
okay.
but I don't think if you get hired as a federal official, no, I don't
okay.
think so. But I don't know that for a fact.
Ellen, in January, more than 1,100 law professors sent a letter to Congress urging the Senate to reject the nomination of Senator Jeff Sessions for Attorney General. It said in part, quote, "We are convinced that Jeff Sessions will not fairly enforce our nation's laws and promote justice and equality in the United States." Do you think we should expect a continued wave of law professor activism, as it were?
I'm not sure law professors would identify themselves as activists. Law professors speak out when they think that there's something fundamentally wrong. And for 1,100 law professors to sign on was really significant. You have someone who's now the Attorney General who was rejected as a federal judge for a whole host of reasons, including his statements about civil rights, about blacks. I mean, just horrific history. He's now the Attorney General. So if we see more circumstances like this, if we see more instances where people like Kellyanne Conway are lying and she's a lawyer, if we see more instances of other lawyers who are behaving in ways that are fundamentally contrary to what lawyers are supposed to do, yes, I think you'll see law professors speaking out.
Ellen, what is the timetable on the Kellyanne Conway complaint? When do you expect to hear from the bar in D.C.?
there's never a way to know. It's like a deep hole, deep six. You know, once you file a disciplinary complaint, it goes to a group of people there. And the question is, are they going to treat it seriously? They get thousands of complaints a year. They only consider a certain number of them. So we have no idea.
If you had your druthers, what would you like to see come out of it?
I'd like to see an ethics opinion. Number one, I'd like an ethics opinion from the D.C. bar, similar to what they did for Elliot Abrams and Scooter Libby, saying, here's why lawyers are bound by, who work for government, are bound by Rule 8.4C. And whether they suspend her from practice, whether they disbar her, is not of grave concern to me. I don't think she should be a practicing lawyer. I don't think clients should trust a person like this. You know, the question people would ask is, well, she might behave differently in private practice than she's behaving in this way, but we don't see any evidence of that. So, you know, I think certainly she should be suspended from practice. By the way, she hasn't paid her dues in D.C., so, you know, she might be suspended anyway from that. We also, by the way, filed in New Jersey because she's an active member of the bar in New Jersey. So after we filed the D.C. complaint, we sent it to New Jersey as well.
New Jersey's pretty strict, isn't it?
New Jersey's strict. New Jersey has considered fewer instances of lawyers who work for government, whereas D.C. is used to those kinds of complaints. So, you know, look, it may be a long shot to think that anything is going to happen, but at the very least, certainly within my world, it's caused quite a stir. And the fact that law professors like Steve LeBay, people are arguing about how far the law, are government lawyers really bound by this rule or not, is important.
Ellen, we're running out of our allotted time, but before we let you go, we'd like to ask you, if we might, a personal question. How did somebody like you get involved in the practice of law? I mean, when you first went to law school, there were very few women, and it was a tough road to hoe. And here you are now teaching ethics. I mean, how did this all come about?
Oh, well, I don't have a few minutes to talk about that. It's a long story. But when I went to, you know, I went to Rutgers Law School in the 70s, which at the time had 50% women. And they were, and it was the first law school in the country that had that many women in addition to Northeastern. And they had clinics. And most of us who were there, the people I was grouped with of the National Lawyers Guild, were people who were social justice activists who believed that one could use the law as a tool for social change. Arthur Kinoy was our professor, he was our mentor, and he, along with other lawyers at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who we worked with, showed us actually how you could use law as a tool for social change. And so throughout my career, I worked at the Center for Constitutional Rights. I was a criminal defense lawyer. I was in Seattle. I worked for Native American tribes. And then when I moved back to New York, and when I was leaving the Center for Constitutional Rights, I actually ended up going into private practice with Barry Scheck, who is now running the Innocence Project. And I worked at Cardozo part-time teaching law, and I really liked it. We got money to start an ethics center. And what the benefactor said was, we like the way that you hands-on teach people how to do trials. So we want you to do that hands-on approach to teaching lawyers legal ethics as well. And that's the beginning of my career in legal ethics. I never intended to be a legal ethicist. But it's really interesting. I like it. I think it provides a really important vehicle to teach students about how to actually represent clients and be in the world as a person who actually makes a difference.
Well, they're so lucky to have you, Ellen.
Oh, thank you.
And we've been fortunate as well. We really want to stay on top of this, so hope to have you back to discuss it further.
I would be delighted.
Yeah. And best of luck.
Thank you for your show.
Well, Ellen Yaroshevsky, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Great.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
We are on the verge of unconstrained military power to suppress dissent under Commander-in-Chief Donald Trump. Section 1021 of the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act would allow him to fully put into effect the military detention and military trial by a military commission of dissenters who oppose government wartime policies or support whistleblowers who bring those policies to light. In the case of Hedges versus Obama, the Department of Justice argued that, quote, the mere expressive activities, end quote, could be sufficient grounds for military detention of civilians, such as journalists and U.S. citizens. Chris Hedges, Daniel Ellsberg, and Noam Chomsky were the plaintiffs in that case, which is ongoing. The conspiracy conviction by a military commission of Mr. Ali al-Bahloul, who made a movie promoting al-Qaeda, is going before the Supreme Court in the next several months. He is represented by three attorneys, including our guest, attorney Todd Pierce. Pierce is a retired Army major. He had previously worked with Michael Ratner on the Guantanamo cases. He's a member of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity.
Todd Pierce, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me here.
Can you briefly outline the facts of the Bahloul case?
Just very quickly, Bahloul is a person who admits to being an al-Qaeda member. And he was picked up, you know, following the invasion of Afghanistan on the Pakistani border, eventually tried in a military commission for three offenses, conspiracy, material support for terrorism, and solicitation for the video, the documentary that he had made, which was basically a Why We Fight style documentary, explaining what it is that they believed gave them justification to fight the West.
He lost his case, was convicted of conspiracy in a military commission. The Court of Appeals, the court just below the American Supreme Court, upheld that conviction. And now you're in the process of going to the American Supreme Court on his case. What's the danger here? What issues are we facing?
So we're asking for a review by the Supreme Court at this stage. But actually, he was charged and convicted of three offenses, material support for terrorism, solicitation, and conspiracy. We argued that none of these were war crimes, and therefore they were not triable under a military commission. Because, again, a military commission is not an Article III court, you know, is not part of our federal court system.
Well, let's just inform our audience that Article III of the Constitution sets up the judicial branch of our government. You know, we've got a three-branch government, and we have courts. But if you have a military commission and you have military trials, that kind of encroaches on the court system.
Exactly. And again, it supplants the court system to the degree that you use them. The Supreme Court has held in the past that only in the most limited circumstances could a military commission be held. But where they were held was during the Civil War, where they were oftentimes used to suppress dissent. And the Supreme Court held at the end of the Civil War that they were unconstitutional, that outside that narrow case where there might be martial law, you cannot have military commissions.
So just to clarify, the sole remaining substantive issue here is whether conspiracy constitutes a war crime.
Correct. And here's where it becomes so dangerous to journalists, dissenters, anyone who might be in opposition to the government in various ways. And that is, we won at the D.C. Circuit Court.
Sorry to interrupt, but can you give an example of how that might be prosecuted? If journalists confer with sources?
Correct. Inchoate conspiracy is such a loosely defined offense, and it can be just two people discussing something, and then you later find out that that person is doing something different, and they in turn may be connected. So it becomes a daisy chain, and they can bring in everybody in this daisy chain and charge them with perhaps aiding terrorism. And the Chris Hedges case stands for that. Although I believe that's been resolved when they held that Hedges and the others did not have standing, so that I believe that case is at an end. But in the course of it, the Department of Justice attorney said that the commander-in-chief, as we've come to routinely call the president now, as if we're in a junta, could and had the authority to deem Hedges, Noam Chomsky, and others as providing support for terrorism. For what there's, I think the term they use, expressive activities. Meaning,
that's the support.
Right.
Right.
And under that case, if that president, commander-in-chief, deemed that to be the situation, and it's an arbitrary line, an arbitrary decision, because that's what the law of war is, they could be put into military detention and held pending disposition under the law of war, which means they could be held the rest of their lives as prisoners, prisoners of war.
I wonder, in a climate that is increasingly hostile to journalists, you would think that this would give more ammunition to the powers that be to prosecute journalists.
I can't understand really why there isn't more attention to this. I've been writing about it, and it's like, you know, nobody pays any attention to me, and, you know, I get on. But no, you can just trace this down, you know, with an illegal analysis, and you can see where this is going. The dangerous thing that came in, okay, the D.C. Circuit Court did hold that two of the offenses that Bahloul had been convicted of were not war crimes, and they vacated those convictions. But they held in a divided court that conspiracy was a war crime, but not under international law, because the government conceded early on that it was not a violation of the international law of war. But it took place internationally, so that would be the only law of war that could apply. But what the government invented was what they now call a U.S. domestic common law of war, and that is what makes us all so dangerous, because part of that would be the Civil War cases where journalists were routinely suppressed, newspaper offices closed, etc. But it would also include the Japanese-American removal cases from the, whole Japanese-American removal during World War II, and a number of other odious acts by the government over the years, all in the guise of wartime, you know, defense.
Todd, I read one of the articles you wrote where you quoted King George III, who said that, quote, a traitor is anyone who does not agree with me. Do you believe that this is the underlying principle upon which every despotic regime or dictatorship holds to?
Absolutely. And where it was brought into U.S., law of war case law, you could say, was with Lieber's code. Francis Lieber was a Prussian immigrant who imported ideas from the Prussian militaristic, you know, system into the U.S. with Lieber's code, which is generally held up as this great humanitarian, step forward. But in fact, it included, in the very first section was labeled martial law. It was the martial law order. General Order Number 100 for the entire United States, the North. And just because, let me just very quickly say that I'm not saying anything in support of the Confederacy. You know, people, their binary thinking, the Confederacy was even more under martial law with slavery, which is the most extreme form of martial law. But the government isn't using the Confederacy as precedent. They're using the martial law cases from the North during the Civil War, which were later denounced by the Supreme Court in In re Milligan, a famous case. But that's what, you know, that is what gives it the guise of legitimacy, because, well, who can complain about the Civil War? We you know, freed the slaves, for example. So it becomes a very convenient propaganda theme as well. So we have this domestic common law of war, supposedly, according to the government, and that would open the door wide open to all these cases from the Civil War, as I say. And again, you just have to read Colonel William Winthrop, whom is always referred to, and he lays them out, lays out a whole bunch of cases. This newspaper office shut down in St. Louis, Missouri. I could go on and on. And one of the offenses, let me just add, was saying anything embarrassing about the Army.
Heidi is shaking her head when you think about how a thin-skinned person like Trump could react to that.
It also fits in a tangential way with the new center that Obama actually signed into law before he left office that creates an anti-propaganda entity to investigate journalists. Largely overseas, but that could apply to internet work, right. That kind of thing.
No, like I say, it really puts us into dangerous territory. Then comes this president with his animosity toward journalists, and it's anybody's guess, but I don't think you couldn't predict anything that would be very favorable to free speech in the United States.
Todd, where are we procedurally in the case? What's the next step?
We have applied to the Supreme Court for review, and we're in the process of that. I've been reaching out to different people for support, amicus support, and of course there's some, but I'm amazed that organizations of journalists, free speech organizations, aren't getting involved. We made an argument early on that this was about the First Amendment, not his First Amendment rights, but rather the American people's First Amendment right, which, if you look at the First Amendment as a whole, is all about the right to know. And we should have a right to know why somebody feels they can fight us, for example. That was, we put that argument aside, or the court sort of did. But conspiracy leaves it wide open because, again, you don't have to have a law saying hereby the First Amendment is here now hereby nullified, but rather you can just say these two journalists are conspiring to support terrorism or some such thing, and then they're in the situation that Hedges was concerned about, where they could be put in a military detention, according to the Department of Justice themselves.
Yeah, conspiracy has always been thought of as the prosecutor's darling because they don't have to prove an underlying crime. It's really like a thought crime.
It absolutely is, and that's what makes us so dangerous. Again, people should be clamoring to support us on this and to oppose the government on it because, again, it really does nullify the rule of law.
And just so listeners are clear, what Todd is referring to is an amicus brief, or friend of the court brief, as it's known, is when supporters choose an aspect of the case and go into more elaborate detail than is usually done in the court briefs, sort of like a law review article. But it's indicative, especially in cases that have this kind of political fallout, potentially people who would be impacted by it or advocates of groups, as you say, such as journalists, would want to chime in and let the Supreme Court know that this is disturbing to them. So when will you be filing?
We have to file March 28th, and the deadline for amicus briefs is April 27th. And let me just add, and I said this when I was on the program one other time, Ernst Fraenkel, who is a German-Jewish lawyer, wrote a book called The Dual State. The first line in it was essentially that the martial law was a constitution of National Socialist Germany. And you can go back in and do an analysis of those laws that applied. And they were identical, again, because wartime law of war domestically is fascist law. That's what fascism always relies upon. Pinochet, Chile was in a war, so he could justify, or he tried to justify what he was doing because they were at war. This is what fascism stands for. It's wartime militarism.
Where essentially the Constitution is suspended in the name of national security.
Right, which I would make an argument if we had more time that that's exactly the opposite of what provides national security. It's anti-democratic and shuts off other voices that might bring more relevant points of view. But
and closes down any kind of oppositional
exactly,
group.
Exactly. Right.
Vietnam. So there's nothing to buffer the dictator from the population.
And let me just add quickly, the generals who came out of Vietnam, Westmoreland and others, they came up with their own stab in the back legend against anti-war activists, the media, and they, in their memoirs, they advocated censorship and other things, and even military detention for dissidents. They couldn't put that into effect then, but it's been creeping in more and more in information policy for the military. And the latest law of war manual that came out 2 years ago made the point that journalists could be deemed unlawful combatants.
Todd, how can people learn more about your work and this particular legal case and try to help you?
I guess I can give you my email, todd.e.pierce@icloud.com. You could also put my name in and do a search on War on Dissent, I think is the title of it, where I pretty much laid all this out in an article on Consortium News. I think I did a pretty good job of explaining what this means.
Todd, on a personal note, if I may, how did you get involved in this case and
Well, I was an Army Reserve JAG officer, and when 9/11 happened, actually, and I could just see the hysteria immediately the same day, Anyway, I was on active duty at the time as a reservist, and I was against the Iraq War for a whole lot of reasons, good reasons. But I stayed in the reserves, and in part because I wanted to volunteer. I expected that there would be military commissions at some point. I stayed in the reserves so I could volunteer for that, which I did in 2008 when they started again, and that's what got me in. But I've been concerned about all these things going on since 9/11, you know, reading people like Chris Hedges.
How did you meet Michael Ratner?
Just through an email list I'm on. And I've been writing on this, and again, even human rights people on this just didn't get it to begin with, but Michael Ratner did. And so he contacted me, you know, individually, and I laid this out and explained to him how this could have been used had we had this in place during the Vietnam War, for example, to suppress any dissent. And again, that's what the generals had wanted. The generals then, Westmoreland, these others, they had their World War II experience when we did, in fact, use martial law in Hawaii, where they did suppress any dissent. It's a great book came out a year or so ago on martial law in Hawaii. And I would suggest people reading it just to see what martial law really means. But again, it's happened here before, and it's there to happen again.
And when you said that you wanted to volunteer in these proceedings, did you actually represent individuals, or what were you doing?
So I've been on three different cases, this one and then two others. One got resolved, and the other one is still going on, but I'm no longer on that, having retired.
You know, Todd, you're a guy from Minnesota. You're one of many, many people, I think, who were just appalled by what happened after 9/11 and the unnecessary kind of militaristic reaction to it and the fear-mongering that was spread. And we've had other people on the show involved in various aspects of the government. Ray McGovern was in the CIA. Ann Wright was a diplomat. And now you. And I just wanted to ask you, what was it really in your background that made you react to this war against Iraq, and why did you recoil at what was done?
Well, I matured. You know, I came of age during the Vietnam War, and won't go into all that. But so this was a constant subject to be read about. You know, what was going on in Vietnam and the various arguments. So I've always had this interest. But in reading all that, reading about the journalists' experiences and whatnot, but I dug deeper into that again back in about 2009, 2010. And let me just say something. Again, I mentioned the Vietnam War generals. Well, they really did have a belief that we were stabbed in the back. And their memoirs all come out arguing, like I say, for military detention in the future. But, you know, the point I like to make about Vietnam was, and it goes to over-deference to the military, is that the Vietnam War generals were all wrong. They didn't know what they were doing. They were martinets, basically. The biggest achievement that Westmoreland had in the 20 years since World War II had been getting a football stadium built at West Point. But the next day, basically, he was on a plane going to Vietnam, writing to his father, telling his father before he'd even got to Vietnam, as well, one obstacle I'm going to have is these journalists in Vietnam who don't know anything. And he was talking about people who had been spending the previous 10 years in Vietnam, knew the country well, knew the South Vietnamese government well, knew that the South Vietnamese government was alienating its own people, and had a far better understanding of whether or not, you know, what Westmoreland was sent to do was even achievable. And they knew it wasn't. The only military officer who's of prominence that come out later was General Wyand, who had told a few people that, no, the war was unwinnable. He was saying that from the beginning because he understood the Vietnam better than Westmoreland and these others. Ray, you mentioned Ray McGovern, and he's founded the Sam Adams Associates for Integrity Intelligence. Sam Adams was a CIA analyst who noted that, you know, the Viet Cong had far more support than Westmoreland was attributing to them, and that meant, had a lot of meaning to it. And anyway, he took it up the CIA chain, trying to get the numbers changed, and they wouldn't do it. They deferred to Westmoreland, and shortly after came the Tet Offensive, costing, you know, a whole lot of Vietnamese lives, but also a whole lot of Americans' lives. And finally, then, you know, people began waking up. But had they been listening to the anti-war movement before, who did have some very eloquent voices giving a much sounder analysis of Vietnam than Westmoreland even had the capability of doing, we might have avoided so much human, the cost of human life, etc., and gotten out of there earlier. And which isn't to say, you know, there could have been a lot of different ways that that war could have ended. You know, maybe a greater reconciliation. I don't know, but in any case, it wouldn't have cost another 40,000 American lives, and as well as another million Vietnamese lives.
Todd, given the composition of the Trump administration, what is your take on having so many persons with military background leading us?
Well, two things. One is, it's not much different than the opposition would have been. If you remember, the Democratic Convention was around, you know, one night dedicated to all the generals, and going back, you know, so we've had this militaristic mindset from the beginning of 9/11, you know, and before that, of course, but 9/11 really brought it out. With Trump, it's right there for all of us to see. Thanks for bringing it up. H.R. McMaster, who's now presented as this really sound military guy who's going to keep Trump in line, he's one of those people who, he come up with a very, you know, his book, Dereliction of Duty, which is so well known now. What he argued was, he cast the blame on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, not for not going to the president and saying this war is unwinnable, but McMaster blames them because they didn't go to the president and demand even more troops, which Westmoreland was always doing. And there's an excellent book, although I disagree with the author in other regards, but by Lewis Sorley on Westmoreland, the general who lost Vietnam. Sorley had his own false interpretations of how Vietnam could have ended up, so I'm not recommending him otherwise. But he did. He was on point in recognizing and all of Westmoreland's weaknesses and vanity, and puts a blame rightly on Westmoreland as well as LBJ and those other hawks of the day for getting that war going and not understanding it, etc. So, but again, McMaster, he didn't see any problem with the Joint Chiefs of Staff not saying get out, but rather is they didn't ask for even more troops, you know, like Westmoreland had wanted.
In Trump's State of the Union speech last week, he wants to give 54 more billion dollars to the military. What's your opinion of doing that?
He's cementing in place the constant threat we're going to have from resistance back, because that's what this terrorism is. I won't get into a deeper history of the Mideast, but it's been driven so much by the West's own military actions in the Mideast. Well documented, so I won't even go into that. But now what he wants to do is he wants to increase that even more with $54 billion for a greater military, you know, greater size military. But the other thing I want to point out is we've got to avoid, in my opinion, this binary opposition when it comes to Trump. I've got so many people who, you know, they see any opposition to Trump as favorable. But keep in mind, John McCain, the guy who wrote Section 1021, and Lindsey Graham and Joe Lieberman was on, and you can read their Senate debate advocating for it. McCain wants to increase the budget for 5 years at an even greater amount per year. And this is what I argue is, you know, Trump, I argue that Trump is a product of 16 years of war. This is what always happens in every war. This is what brought Germany Hitler. You know, they were in a state of war basically from World War I on. And out of it popped Adolf Hitler. But the one who really gave birth to Adolf Hitler was General Ludendorff. And again, there's a way of military thinking that goes to anything that causes the public to lose its will is aiding the enemy. And that's the root cause of this idea, this belief that you've got to suppress any dissent. So here we've got McMaster. He's not the rational alternative, but he's something every bit as bad, and if not worse. And McCain calling for even more money. And this constant, this perpetual state of war we're now in is going to lead us deeper and deeper into radical militarism. Fascism is really the term for it. And I'll just end this by saying, you know, 8 more years or 4 more years of war might well bring us Senator Tom Cotton, who I think by any realistic analysis of what fascism is, would be probably the prototype that we have on the political scene today. So yeah. Things can get worse than Trump, believe me.
Yeah, no, I do believe you. Michael Ratner always said, you know, you can't have constant war abroad and democracy at home. And I think that's a sobering thought to end up our interview. And thank you, Attorney Todd Pierce, so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for having me here.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.